I might as well quit while I'm ahead. Okay, can you guys hear me? I'm going to be reading a lot. It's from my upcoming book, Art for the Third Millennium, Creating a New Worldview. I started out as a poet, but gave up poetry for the visual expression when I lost my language, my mother tongue. I realized that art had to change in a world drastically changing when humanity was facing major decisions in order to survive on the planet while striving to maintain moral values and the quality of life. I wanted to cleanse art from its elitist self-involvement to achieve greater universal validity. I left the ivory tower of my studio and entered the world of concerns. I wrote books, spoke at global conferences, and began to create large-scale environmental projects called Philosophy in the Land. I created Rice Tree Burial, the first large-scale ecological site work in 1968 with these concerns in mind. You see images of that here on the wall. These works brought ecological, cultural, and social issues, explored the paradoxes of human existence, and addressed global survival. My early work took me into investigating all disciplines, the sciences, technology, evolution, dialectics, logic, time, and truth functions, a Herculean task, although I did not realize it at the time. I was beginning to unite disciplines alienated through specialization and came to look at art as the integrator of disciplines and saw the role of the artist as developing a new vision for humanity. I began by visualizing invisible processes such as logic, thought processes, evolution, time, sound, and mathematics. They became the building blocks for my pyramids, expressions of social philosophy that became survival structures for humanity dealing with global warming and climate change in the future cities designed over 30 years ago. The issues touched on in my work range between individual creation and social consciousness. I believe that the new role of the artist is to create an art that questions the status quo, the direction of life has taken, the endless contradictions we accept and approve, offering intelligent alternatives and often benign solutions. I plant forests on abused land to be kept alive for centuries and fields of grain in the heart of megacities. This work goes beyond just planting a field or a forest or creating master plans for large territories in need of rebuilding. It is benign problem solving and shaping, structuring the future, an egoless art form that calls attention to social concerns and involves people from all walks of life. They are meant to build pride and self-esteem in people, inspiring young minds to feel good about themselves and have the courage to achieve their dreams. This new art form goes beyond the self and the ego without being selfless. It assumes the difficult task of maintaining a delicate balance between thinking globally and acting independently. For the ego must remain intact to allow the self to act fearlessly with the certainty and confidence necessary for true creation, while the ego must be relinquished in order to think universally and for the good of others. Self-esteem versus selflessness. Rice Tree Burial, first realized in 1968, but philosophical in orientation, and dealt with our relationship to the earth and the future. I was asked to reenact the project on a larger scale at Art Park in 1977. I planted a rice field above the Niagara Gorge at the Canadian border, chained in a sacred Indian forest, and buried the time capsule to be opened 1,000 years from now. It included my haiku poetry. I kept no copies. It was a symbolic event that announced my commitment to environmental issues and human concerns. Then I went out to the edge of Niagara Falls before barricades existed, and for 8 days and nights lived a foot away from the torrent, where 16,000 gallons of water was going over every second. The ground shook under my feet, It had been dynamited to control the retreat of the falls, and I had to sign a document to both the US and Canadian governments that if I fell in and died, I would not sue them. Rice Reburial, its thesis, antithesis, synthesis, life, death, transcendence. As we put the seed in the earth to grow, bury the dead, communicate with the future. Rice, the life-giving element, causation, creation. Tree, chaining, interference with life, change, death. Time capsule, preservation of concepts, transcendence, communication with the future. I'm going to show you some images with the rice field. This is me planting the seed. It was on the edge of the U.S. and Canada. It set up an irrigation system on the left is the U.S., on the right you see Canada. And then I grew radioactive rice. It was not planned, but we brought soil in from Love Canal, nearby Love Canal, and it contaminated my rice. And I worked with a doctor of rice from Louisiana, and I told him, I have red rice. He says, lady, you have no red rice. They only grow red rice in China. So I said, well, I'll send it to you. And I sent him the seed, and he called me back, and he says, lady, you have red rice. So much for the doctor of rice. We found out that it was contaminated because the plants grow, pull the nutrients up from the soil, and it brought the contamination up. So I learned that we have to be careful with contaminating. You know, this is the red rice that can go, and of course it killed the field. Now this is when I chained the forest, the sacred Indian forest that we were told it had been cursed by the Indians that were massacred there. Hundreds of them buried there, and I had some incredible experiences, but we can't go into that now. My talk would take forever. I'm going to show you images of the chaining, me chaining the tree. This is, I created sculptural form. This is the chamber, the portal, and a cathedral. And this is the burial of the time capsule. It will be opened 1,000 years from now, and you're all invited. I also designed other time capsules, planned for 5,000 years in the future, and eventually 50,000 and 1,000,000 years. I wanted to investigate what would happen to humanity in the distant future, what mode of communication would be appropriate, and where to place the time capsules. I thoroughly investigated Antarctica, where to place it, in what ice shelf, how to retrieve it in salt water, and so on. But even within the fraction of a second of my lifetime, Antarctica is melting. So much for human planning. Then I was thinking of sending it into space. I designed that eventually with my future flying space stations in 1980 that I will be showing you later. And since I want the future to evaluate us, not by the object we make that usually get into time capsules, but our mind, I offered to take the result of this lecture series, The Future Is, responses, and put them into my next time capsule. I have a questionnaire with previous responses. Then I climbed out to the edge of Niagara Falls, well, before there were railings there. The ground shook under my feet as it had been dynamited to control the retreat of the falls. That's why I had to sign the document. It was probably the most frightening experience of my life. I can't imagine, on the other hand, a more appropriate setting to contemplate the power of nature and our human insignificance. This is me setting up, and then after we were set up, I was alone for 8 days and 8 nights. The nights were incredibly scary because I was a foot away from death. And I took these pictures. I take all my own pictures in my work. Now we get to my other project, Wheatfield, A Confrontation. In 1982, I planted and harvested 2 acres of wheat in Manhattan's financial district on land worth $4.5 billion. Wheatfield was about greed, misuse of land, mismanagement of resources. It was a calling to account. Wheatfield was a symbol. It represented food, energy, commerce, world trade, economics, and referred to waste, world hunger, and ecological concerns. I'm going to show you some pictures now of Wheatfield, and this is the green wheat. The Statue of Liberty across the Hudson in Jersey. I was one block from Wall Street. And then I photographed everything that managed to come and live in my ecosystem, which I found amazing, that a block from Wall Street, I had all this life coming. I had thousands and thousands of ladybugs. I had mollusks. This is a mollusk that actually, I was told, swam across the surface tension of the Hudson to come to be in my field. That's what I call attendance. And you guys, I really want to thank you for showing up. I almost didn't make it from the heat. I really appreciate you being here. So I appreciated the mollusk. And here is my spider. And this was the most photogenic and photo-conscious spider. Every time the TV crews came, it went into a dance. And the photographers came just to see the spider dance. I was wondering if they came to see my field or the spider. Now, after my harvest, and then 4th of July, the boat that sprays red, white, and blue water came and sprayed the wheat field. And the ocean liners saluted us every time they passed. That's the financial district, a block away. Oh, that's me, the old man in the sea. There's the ocean liners. I was a foot away from the Hudson. My aerial photo and my harvest. Now, after my harvest, the hay went to the mounted police in New York for the horses to use everything. And the grain traveled to 22 cities around the world in an exhibition to end world hunger, organized by the Minnesota Museum of Art. The seeds were then carried away by people who planted them in many parts of the globe in solidarity with the concept. I did this project in 1982, but it gained added poignancy after 9/11 disaster, just 2 blocks away from my Wheatfield site. I returned to photograph the aftermath, inhaling the burning asbestos and other carcinogenic material. I developed a very serious lung infection. This is Tree Mountain, called Tree Mountain, a living time capsule, 11,000 trees, 11,000 people, 400 years. Tree Mountain is a vast earthwork and reclamation project involving 11,000 people who came from all over the world to plant trees on a mountain built from mined land material. Tree Mountain will be maintained for 4 centuries. thereby creating the first man-made virgin forest. It is considered one of the largest reclamation sites in the world and the first to deal with developing a virgin forest for our descendants. It will take about 4 centuries for the ecosystem to rebuild itself. And the idea is that as restitution, whoever destroys the land has to plant trees, but planting trees does not create forests. The planters received an inheritable document, the first such contract in human history that reaches about 20 generations or 400 years into the future. The trees are planted into an intricate mathematical pattern, uniting nature with the human mind. The trees is the product of nature, the mathematics of the forest design, the product of the human intellect. I wanted to fuse the two. I was speaking at the global conference in Rio de Janeiro, showing my mathematical forest design when I was invited by Finland to be the first government to create a monumental reclamation site by an artist and a government working together. My concept is based on the fact that restitution does not create a forest, and we need forests for our ecosystem and the equilibrium of ours. The problem began when looking for a site. I needed a mountain. Any mountain not having trees meant no trees could grow on it. And I wasn't going to cut down the existing ones. And thus my mountain building profession began. It took another 4.5 more years to build the mountain as restitution of a mining company that had destroyed the land through strip mining. Tree Mountain was completed in 1996, 13 years after I had designed it. Today, they are beginning to replicate Tree Mountain in other countries around the world, just as the seeds of wheat field were carried away by people. It takes time for the seed of an idea to take root in the world. The snow-covered mountain, and is the beginning of the growth of the trees. And I'm still waiting for more updated photographs of the mountain. Now we get to Crystal Fort, another project. Master Plan Nieuwe Hollandse Waterlinie, the new Dutch water line. In 2000, I was invited to redesign 85 kilometers of the center of Holland, make it green, environmentally sustainable, and water safe. I created a 25-year master plan. It involved the planting of 100,000 trees to hold the land from erosion, similar to my concept for my forest in Australia, repairing and building sea walls, dunes, dikes, and levees, better and stronger water management system, and new uses for the old 16th century forts that used to protect the country from its neighboring enemies and now sat uselessly occupying the site. I think you can see some of the forts in this photograph. The master plan, as usual, involved urban planning, architecture, landscaping, forestry, water management, and a dozen other fields. To deal with the expense of a complicated master plan, I designed a full-size glass fortress that stands as total opposite to the opaque fortresses of the past occupying the site. With its myriads of reflections, this unique structure was meant to enhance tourism and help defray the costs of the master plan. Today, I'm including the Netherlands when considering other low-lying countries threatened by rising seas and storm surges, along with the Rockaway Shores project I will mention in a moment. Circle of megaliths with sundial, the wilds, 1992, Muskingum County, Ohio, outside of Columbus. The Wilds is a 9,000-acre reclamation site and breeding preserve for endangered species from around the world. It is also a future zoo, a frozen zoo. The sperm of endangered species that are brought here is preserved, taken, and frozen for future use. The place deals with land reclamation and species reclamation. I designed a ceremonial, spiritual place that evokes the past and the future. I'm sorry I don't have better images, but I am just transferring my slides from my slides into PowerPoint, and this is what you get. I'm sorry. I'll do better next time. I designed a ceremonial space. It celebrates saving the animals from the endangered list and reclaiming devastated land. Oh, let me show you some of the animals that are brought to this place. The tall standing stones evoke the past, ancient time telling, like Stonehenge, casting their shadow in the water that changes as the earth turns. A lake separates the stones from the sundial on the other side of the water. It is a unique high-tech sundial with state-of-the-art computerized features. It counts down the endangered species, indicates geographic location and celestial phenomena today and in the future. The water between them is the timeless zone, emphasizing the precious commodity water will become in the near future. A forest for Australia at the Altoona Treatment Plant, Melbourne, Australia, 400 meters by 80 meters. It is a forest of 6,000 trees planted in 1998 to address endangered species, land erosion, and drought facing the continent. I planted trees with varying heights at maturity into five spirals. I don't know if I have images of that. No, sorry. Create a step pyramid for each spiral when the trees are fully grown, using some eucalyptus, river red gum, and other species. I designed this project to motivate others to plant more forests on the continent to help alleviate serious land erosion and desertification threatening Australia. If you create something beautiful and provocative, people will want to emulate it. In the following years, facing serious drought, some of the trees died, and a group that called themselves the Friends of Agnes Dennis proceeded to replant the dying trees. I have no news of the present state of the project, which is always bad news. Poetry walk, reflections, pools of thought. University of Virginia, Charlottesville, 2000. It was the first public art project for the university. This work rescues the essence of great minds from sinking into dusty memory by bringing them into fruitful use and present relevance. Invited by the University of Virginia, I selected poets and philosophers from all ages and backgrounds and carved their writings, their vision, into 20 large granites of various beautiful colors, weighing about 300 pounds each. They are placed across the Jefferson Lawn, across the university where the students sit, play, and have their lunch. I don't care how wisdom enters into the students from the top down or from the bottom up. The carved granites with their high polish reflect the swaying trees, the swaying branches of trees and people, and resemble pools of moving water with the words floating on top. Poetry walk is a gift to Jefferson University and its students to make them reflect, be encouraged to affect change, and perhaps see the world in a better light. Human values expressed with a passion create a lasting impact. They enlighten, motivate, and inspire young minds. The writers I selected are Emerson, Shaw, E. Cummings, Gustave Flaubert, Indira Gandhi, Walt Whitman, Tolstoy, Washington, the Declaration of Independence, and Jefferson's writing for his university, William James, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Socrates, Aristotle, Martha Graham, Immanuel Kant, T.S. Eliot, Eleanor Roosevelt, Robert Frost, etc. This is me talking to the students who are now wise. Oh, I don't know how they've made it in here. This is light matrix, a philosophical concept that takes three-dimensional form and then becomes light. I use this triangular matrix not just to build the pyramids, but to capture elusive philosophical concept for a moment of contemplation. Here the abstract idea becomes illumination. Thought becomes light. The sculpture is about 7 or 8 feet tall. Pyramids of Conscious, by the way, I'm reading to you from my upcoming book. Pyramids of Conscience. There were 4 new pyramids added to the pyramid series in 2005. The Pyramids of Conscience touches on immediate issues of clean water, politics, human weaknesses, and survival issues. They refer to the global problem we must soon face with the life-giving substance of clean water slowly disappearing, and point to the politics that surrounds it. Some problems are immediately visible, others are in the future, and therefore get ignored. I made these sculptures for an exhibition, Treading Water in Marfa, Texas, dealing with the privatization of water and things to come, the issues of population expansion and its needs, with fresh water hanging in the balance. One of the pyramids is filled with crystal clear water, the other with polluted water from the Rio Grande. The third is filled with crude oil and the common denominator. Here you see it better. And another is a mirror in which you see yourself reflected of what you do, fight against, or succumb to. It reflects the drama of it all. They are 9 feet tall, 4-sided pyramids on pedestals made like giant fish tanks, and when filled, weigh about 1.5 tons each. A quick note here that today, after the tsunami, contaminated water is posing a new problem at the damaged Fukushima power plant, where to store the high radioactive water needed to cool the irradiated fuel rods. Interim solutions store it in tanks that leak, and then to dilute the tritium levels are then spilled into the Pacific Ocean. The whole world is functioning on interim solutions. Sheep in the Image of Man, 1998. I was at the Academy researching the rise and fall of complex societies with emphasis on where we stand and how our civilization may react to severe changes in order to survive when I decided to bring sheep into this pristine environment that created the powerful paradox I sought usually inherent in my work. The sheep was a symbol for endangered species, loss of cropland due to overgrazing, soil depletion, urban expansion, also genetic and bioengineering, as this was during the cloning of Dolly. The sheep also suggests today's humanity, racing without seeing an objective, running and being pushed without the ability to think clearly, freely, objectively, and then act on a vision. The entire herd is racing, plunging headlong in this direction or that, without plan or perspective. We are a global society, but there is no unified plan or thinking or action. The sheep were adorable. I got them drunk on champagne, and they drank it out of my hands and the fellows at the academy, and mad, drunkenly refusing to go home with the pastore. Even dumb sheep know that champagne is no hay. Now, we get to the flying pyramids, the future cities. 1984. This deals with global warming, weather changes, and human survival. This is an important project, but I allude to it in an extremely reduced form. The pyramids weave in and out of my work from the beginning, very beginning, in diverse forms, dealing with the great variety of issues important to humanity, present and future. Called the perfect pyramids, they represent our society as the pyramids of Egypt came to represent theirs. They're metaphors for our time. They depict a society in the process of tempering with its destiny, with comparisons made to rise and fall of previous advanced societies that have interfered with their evolution. I'm very snaky. I always get the philosophy in one way or another. In the flying pyramids, future cities, the static pyramids awaken, as in awakening conscience or consciousness, take on dynamic forms to create environments that help the inhabitants of Earth survive. I created these exotic forms over 30 years ago to deal with global warming and climate change in a time when these issues were conjecture and not taken seriously. The restless pyramids create self-supporting city dwellings that can sustain their inhabitants and space stations for future space travel with flexible, self-repairing units. This is the birth of giant fish pyramids for creating underwater habitats, or pyramids in the shape of an egg or a teardrop. I'll go through this later. They are created for a world in which the inhabitants will live in space, hovering above Earth, or else live on Earth in self-contained environments in order to survive. They are protected from weather changes caused by global warming, atmospheric turbulences, and chemical reactions that form super tornadoes, tsunamis, hurricanes, and floods beyond today's measures. These structures are not science fiction. They are the product of high technology, yet another perfection, quote, that are that of the flexibility of natural systems. They have a look of freshness and vulnerability. They are the future, and the future is always vulnerable, unused, ready to be invented. I'm only showing you here the drawings I created for the concept, hand-drawn as they were done before computers, but there are other architectural renderings to show how to build them. The Egg Pyramid is a self-contained, self-supporting city dwelling, a structure designed to house and completely sustain its inhabitants, providing food, education, healthcare, entertainment, and other needs. Using sunlight for power, it grows its own food and recycles material for various diverse uses. Fish Pyramid is a resilient and versatile water habitat, a floating underwater city that supports life on or underwater as either becomes necessary. It utilizes the 7/10 of the vast space on Earth that is not used by humanity to live in or on in large numbers. It uses the multitude of effects that water supplies with its buoyancy and protective elements from damage in the atmosphere. This is the snail pyramid. What happened to the flying pyramids? Okay. Probability pyramid is seen through the eyes of a scallop, is what you're looking at. Is an angular lopsided form that suggests additional dimensions, difficult to pin down and visualize, nevertheless important to understand. This drawing is created with charcoal I brought back from Herculaneum and Pompeii, deposited during the Vesuvius eruption, risking serious jail term if caught. Oh, this is when a pyramid awakens. And here, flying bird pyramid for the 22nd century and a flying hair bird are the first space environments of space station with flexible, self-regenerating or easy to repair units, modules resembling natural systems. These forms, when exhibited, were flat on a table because walking around them will make them appear to be moving. Teardrop in Space is a floating monument or spaceship, if you wish, that can turn sideways and roll if necessary for speed, like a corkscrew in space. I don't seem to have an image of that. There are other works in this series, The City of Fools and The City of the Paradox. They should be worked on and developed in sustainable structures. They are grand mandalas that define our destiny. North Waterfront Park, another master plan was North Waterfront Park in Berkeley, California, 1989 to 1991. For the conversion of a 97-acre landfill surrounded by water on three sides that sits in the San Francisco Bay. I was given two landscape architects to work with for 2 years and made 16 trips to the site working with leaders of the community. It became the first landfill that proposed to initiate bioremediation programs, methane-eating microbes to clean up its own garbage and dig for fresh water. Beneath, new at the time. Although I'm foremost an artist, my large-scale environmental work requires knowledge beyond the techniques of art and becomes a blend of architecture, landscaping, design, urban planning, soil science, mathematics, forestry, the social sciences, and philosophy. Since a landfill is the only place on Earth without a history, I set out to create it, give it one. Designed an amphitheater, petroglyphs carved into earth and stone, wooded hills and view mounds, ghost ships sitting in the bay, lighthouses that use sunlight to emit at night. I may have an image of that. Shore sculptures whose rock embedments strengthen the shorelines. And a singing fountain that worked with the tides. The design included a wildflower and sunflower meadow, a lake, and a small forest, also unique to a landfill. The master plan was approved by the city in 1991. Okay, now we can come to my present project, Mega Dunes and Barrier Islands to Hold Back the Sea, a project for the Rockaways and the New York Harbor. 2013 and going. I've been working on the Rockaway Peninsula, the Mega Dunes and Barrier Islands project since Sandy hit our shores. But actually began this work 40 years ago, speaking at global conferences in Moscow, Rio de Janeiro, Kyoto, and London about global warming, climate change, and the ramifications or pitfalls of geoengineering. I'm bringing my expertise, having worked on low-lying areas before with projects in the Netherlands and elsewhere, to this project now at our shores, researching the possibilities and working with scientists as I go. I'm weighing the pros and cons and will design what's best. I am not in it to make a name for myself, nor to make money. The people are important. I'm proposing a preliminary sample dune system or pilot for one of the neighborhoods in the Rockaways. The mega dunes will be planted with pitch and pond pines, sand grasses, assorted vegetation, and rock material. The shallow interlocking roots of trees will give additional strength to the sand dunes. I use similar methods for my landfills and coastal regions in my work since the 1980s. I'm working with scientists and looking at examples of how Japan responded to the tsunami. That's Japan. Responded to the tsunami, obliterating its shores. Also systems installed in St. Petersburg, New Orleans, Venice, and the Netherlands, where the dunes along the coast are 30 feet high. But no people live there to object to the high dunes obliterating their views, as they do here. Afforestation of the peninsula will eventually become a coastal ecosystem. As Tree Mountain, my forest in Finland, will become the first man-made virgin forest in the future. Originally, I was invited to work with a group called Inclimate Climate Change Solutions Awareness and Action. Inclimate collaborates with artists, climate change specialists, and community organizations to find solutions to climate change in underserved neighborhoods in three boroughs of New York City, including areas most vulnerable. Curator Regina Cornwell conceived and is organizing Inclimate, or In Climate, under the auspices of Franklin Furnace Archives, run by Martha Wilson, both artists and activists, in partnership with Rockaway Waterfront Alliance and its executive director, Jean DuPont. There are other people at the Far Rockaway Alliance I hope to work with, and of course, the scientists, geologists, and oceanographers. In addition to the mega dunes, I'm also proposing to create public art at the Rockaways that would make it a destination, and as with my previous environmental projects around the globe, support the community and elevate their status in the world. The barrier islands will be situated further offshore in the water. You see some preliminary drawings here, and eventually in the New York Harbor to slow down the ocean waves before they even hit the shores. I'm in the process of working on researching shallow waters for possible island creation with scientists. New York has complicated waterfronts, and beside the islands, there are mechanical barriers, levees, flood walls, dams, and wetlands that could be created depending on further research. I've already presented this project at the PS1 Dome in Rockaways, invited by the Rockaway Waterfront Alliance, run by Jean DuPont and Klaus Biesenbach from PS1, who introduced me. The project was enthusiastically welcomed by the community, and the students offered to help plant the trees and vegetation to strengthen the dunes and the islands. I usually work with community in all my projects, and with Tree Mountain, the whole globe became a community. The interference with a project of this magnitude is expected to be as strong as the ocean waves, but I'm used to being on the edge and going against the tide. Well, here happens to be the ocean. What's most important here is to help people. The Far Rockaway community, New York, and around the world, where ocean waves will flood the shores. The last image I am showing you is GUT, Grand Unification Theory, a satirical or humorous way of looking at the end of the earth, well, not the earth, just human existence. The ocean has taken over, and a pathetic electrical connection is the remnant of human intervention. Another exaggeration of human self-importance to assume we can kill the earth. Our actions can only kill us. The earth will heal itself and be here long after we are gone. Think of that. I would like to end with a paragraph from my book of dust, The Predicament, written about 50 years ago. Still relevant. It applies to the sheep and to us. For the first time in human history, the whole earth is becoming one interdependent society with our interests, needs, and problems intertwined and interfering. The threads of existence have become so tightly interwoven that one pull in any direction can distort the whole fabric, affecting millions of threads. Just as a noise or command can cause a herd of sheep to change course and change in the opposite direction. All processes and numbers have accelerated, and the world seems to be ruled by sheer momentum. Our explosive success, vast numbers, and the resources we consume create imbalances affecting all other life forms on Earth. The genetic evolution of these life forms is much slower than our cultural evolution and cannot keep up with the changes we have created. The normal balances of nature no longer control us. Since we have deviated from all previous life forms, there are no precedents for our behavior. Our acceleration is so recent and so rapid that we have had no time to contemplate the consequences. We simply do not know what happens in a world run by human logic that is beyond the ordinary laws of nature, nor do we know the dangers of tampering with the future and our own destiny. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Agnes. Do you want to take a couple of questions?
Sure.
Could come here.
Oops.
Perhaps your lecture was so amazing, there's no question. It was really great. Thank you so much.
No
it
question.
Was really. No question? Do you want to come here?
A brave woman.
Thank you. Agnes, just it's wonderful to hear you describe your work because it's so epic. And it's actually that question that I have of you is the while you emphasize the structures of participation, the collective production that you design into your work, I'd love to hear more details about how you actually organize that very, very hard work that you know cultural institutions know so well of how people turn up, keep building, keep producing, particularly on this large scale, to produce something like the... How hard is it to have 11,000 people come and plant a tree and make sure they all plant it in the right place? And I mean, it seems like that's very hard. I want to hear the details of the work that's often hidden that we can see behind your work of this collective production, which you emphasized in your talk. Does that make sense?
I think she wants to know how are you convincing and seducing 11,000 people to go for something.
Oh, well, that's easy.
That's easy, because we follow you.
It's building the mountain is difficult. I was invited, I think I read that in Rio. Did I read that?
Yes.
That I was invited to work with the government. And then I worked with the municipality of Ilojärvi, which is two-thirds up in Finland, close to the North Pole. And they gave me access, and the United Nations that funded the project partially. I usually work on a shoestring. I never have enough money. And don't let anybody hear this, because then I'm not going to get any money. I did Wheatfield with $10,000, believe it or not. And my blood and sweat. But the people came because, why did the people come? The people came because, oh, I planted the first tree with the president of Finland. And he announced to all the world leaders to plant a tree. And they announced it to the people. That's how it happened. So, yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah.
I never thought about it. Anybody else? Anything else? Anything else? No, good night, have a drink.
Thank you. Thank you, Agnes. Thank you so much.